top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die, only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
Welcome to Spring Break. Annual migration of the idiots.
Edward Diablo Santor, the state stands ready to execute you as charged. Do you have any last words?
May the Lord have mercy on you.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 293, Nightmare Beach, featuring the denizens of Nick's Bar. But you'll be mistaken if you think this is It's a Wonderful Life, although it's pretty wonderful. This is Umberto Lenzi's epic slasher film from the late 80s, Nightmare Beach.
Yeah, a bit of a slasher, a bit of a giallo as well. Mm-hmm. I forgot the killer. But it's funny because you call this epic. Meanwhile, this is a man who directed Nightmare City. He took on an entire city experiencing a nightmare. Now, now we're limiting it.
Manatee
to just a
Beach is not a city?
It's a city upon itself, I guess. It's a rip-roaring...
it's a bustling metropolis at least 2 weeks of the year.
Yep. I mean, this is Umberto Lenzi. I mean, in addition to Nightmare City, he's also directed Cannibal Ferox, Eaten Alive, Seven Bloodstained Orchids, which we also podcasted.
Almost Human, Spasmo.
I love that title.
Yeah.
he's one of the best. So, Nightmare Beach. And there may be a few times in the podcast when I call it Nightmare City, but this is Nightmare Beach.
Whatever you call it, it's a nightmare. And the nightmare that's being plagued on this town is that of a motorcycle madman on the loose.
Well, I thought you were going to say that is the yearly tradition known as Spring Break. Which is
That could be. Now, Spring Break is not really much of a thing in Canada, but apparently in Florida, it's what it keeps the economy booming, along with crystal meth and attendance at one of Disney World's various parks.
Theme parks, yeah.
My God. Breakers, that they're called. I think we're in some sort of a duel or trucker movie, like Breaker, Breaker, 1, 2, 3. Breakers, as the locals have dubbed them, descend upon this town en masse by the thousands to engage in sexual exploits, the likes of which haven't been seen since Caligula in ancient Rome, with the gyrating bodies, wet t-shirt, much of it B-roll, let's be honest, mm-hmm. and just shot after the fact. And
B-roll and C-cup roll and D-cup roll.
And fat rolls too, but not many. Lots of beach bait.
Even some males as well, so there's some equal opportunity. Cheesecake on display and beefcake along with that cheese.
Mostly cheese, and the citizens start disappearing on account of this killer, although the killings are being ascribed to a gang, sort of a 1%er biker gang called Fabulously Demons, who have the demons logo on their
back of their
copyright infringing on the back of their leather their cuts. So,
although I mean, maybe Lindsay is friends with Lamberto Bava and got permission to use it, but I thought that was a really cool touch. Actually, have the demons logo on
it
the back.
It was kind of neat.
I mean, it was kind of like it was a demons logo, but it was a little off kilter. So maybe it was a copyright infringement. I say, yeah, let's just use it. We'll call it the gang Demons. Let's use the logo. And so they went as close as they possibly could without actually using it. But
Now, speaking of devils, what launches this movie is Diablo, who's an ex-biker who is given the chair for his various transgressions. Mm. And he's zapped in, you know, spectacular fashion. And the time-honored tradition for the officials attending this guy's demise is the call from the governor. Governor says it's all good, and so he's not saved. Zap, zap, zap. Done.
Yep.
Now,
and in attendance is his the sister of one of his victims, and a cop who was responsible, I guess, for putting the case together.
He wants to see his work done right to
and
the very end.
This cop's name is
Stryker, right at airplane.
By the indefatigable John Saxon.
Although he looked pretty fatigued here,
he did look fatigued in this movie. Yeah,
it's basically him from Nightmare on Elm Street. He just the cop wandering around, just glowering at people.
And also there's the medical examiner, played by the wonderful Michael Parks as well. So there's a good cast in this one.
Yeah, genre stalwart. So this is, you got to say, a very, very elaborate, and this is not a spoiler, or maybe it's a partial spoiler, but a very elaborate red herring to start the right off the bat, because the killer's MO has something to do with electricity.
Exactly.
So, oh, there's a electric chair themed horror movie. His name escapes me.
With Shocker.
Shocker. Incredible VHS box cover art. It's another 80s one that was on my list, which I never saw.
I've talked about many times in this podcast my antipathy towards horror when I was a youth, and how it really had a very, very visceral effect on me, and I couldn't watch many movies. But one time, I was maybe 14, 15 years old, I was at a slumber party. And
hopefully no massacre.
There was no massacre. But there was Shocker that was rented on VHS, and it was being played for those of us at the slumber party. And me being as terrified as I was, I actually put on a set of headphones, so whatever 80s music was playing at the time, maybe Debbie Gibson or Tiffany, and I covered my head with a blanket. But every so often, I would sort of peek at the screen, and then I was kind of like, you know what, this is not so bad. And I watched about 3/4 of the movie. But,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
And this one...
I remember that's Mitch Pileggi, I believe, was the...
oh my God, your powers of recall are beyond...
Well, I could be mistaken, but I'm...
Now, what I will be mistaken in, and I did what the name of one of the characters would implore me to do. His name is Skip, and I did that with all the character names, so I'm really not well-versed as to who all these people are. But our main protagonist is a failed college football star who's got zero joie de vivre. He's surrounded by thousands of buxom, beautiful, undulating bodies, and he's a wet blanket.
Well, I mean, to his defense, he's sort of not into it. He had just recently blown a massive play at the Rose Bowl, and it was in Sports Illustrated, apparently. It was all over TV.
Yes.
And everywhere he went, people were reminding him of his
five interceptions.
His gridiron gaffe. And,
but still, couldn't he find comfort in the you know, heaving bosom of one of the ladies on the beach? I mean, come on.
And his friend.
Especially being so allegedly famous.
Yeah, and fairly good looking, too. Mm. And his friend, who looked like a roided up Ralph Macchio, was trying to get him to sort of get out of his shell and, you know, get paid in some debauchery.
Yeah. And in this pivotal scene, I mean, this is like Play It Sam with Humphrey Bogart. I mean, this is so iconic, right? This is the dumping of the prophylactics onto the bed and the urging that we're going to have the greatest time
this
week. We're
going to use every single one by the time this week is over. Meanwhile, there's like 40 prophylactics, so...
And
unless they want to use them for water balloons, throw them out the balcony. I don't see them using them before the weekend's over.
It's true. It's unfortunately for the procurer, he is not long for this earth and will not be able to engage in, you know, anything with anybody, despite it, not for lack of trying. He's hitting on anything with X chromosomes. Yep. This guy is like just a rutting pig of Me Too, pre-Me Too. Just, hey, baby, like, I play football. It's just a gross character. Yep. And the fact that he met his maker so quickly really didn't bother me too much. Yep. You know,
well, he's not the first victim of the killer, the motorcycle killer, but he's definitely one of the earlier victims. So, let's describe this killer.
Oh, fantastic. Well, in a callback to the Cracker Jack opening scene with the electrocution, the motorcycle killer's MO is to use...
He's all dressed in black leather. He's got the black helmet with the visor kind of fully concealing his face.
And his MO is to electrocute people through his motorbike, which is retrofitted with some weird metal trident stuck to the back, and that he, I don't know what he does, like to rig this up with some high voltage, because it's different. Sometimes he puts wires together, and then other times he sort of takes the hand of one of his victims and taps it on the back of the motorbike. It's very odd. No. But he also like can garrote people at times. So he's kind of versatile with his killing.
Yeah, and every time he kills somebody, there is some degree of electrocution involved. And as you were saying before, the big red herring is Diablo come back from the grave to exact revenge?
Yeah.
And they even go to his grave, and it's empty. And
dun, dun, dun.
The demon gang is running havoc throughout this town. I mean, they're causing havoc, and they're getting no end of the business from Stryker.
Which is pretty funny, because you got to figure, like, a gang that's this tough, these guys are like Hell's Angels, and really, It's one striker against 40, and his word is so powerful that they will head for the hills if he says, get lost, guys, and that's it. They're done.
You would think he'd be like, yeah, copper area, you may just try and make copper. Us. You know? Yeah, more authority than Brian Bosworth and Stone Cold. I mean,
oh, the parallels are unbelievable. Yeah, and it's just amazing that those two heads collide, and then these two forces collide too, because the murder of this, you know, roided up dummy is initially pinned on the gang, and it makes sense because they bury him out in some quarry,
really mine site. Cool. I mean, they don't alert anybody. You know, they find the body, they don't alert the family, they don't give him proper burial. They just take him out to this quarry and cover him up with limestone, and that's the end of that. For him to be discovered by the wet blanket football player and the sister of the initial one who was killed, and I say that in quotes, because they do sort of infer that there was some sort of shady police business.
Yeah.
Who killed the sister of this lady that runs the bar.
Not very well developed plot, but really ultimately what it's up to the protagonist, Skip, and his new barmaid pal to start solving the spate of murders, because the lead investigator striker is really quite uninterested in the proceedings or unwilling to really poke the hornet's nest that is the you know, Hell's Angels or whatever.
Well, yeah, I mean, there sort of is a reason for that, but we're not going to get into it for want of spoilers.
I don't want to tread upon what we've learned, but my God, like, just glorious lines of moments between the different characters. One little bit of banter is, this is a great bit of exposition where Gail, I believe the bartender, and she's paired up with
the
Skip.
Box and bartender buddy of
she's,
Skip. Yeah.
She's kind of Italian looking. She's got that dumb look on her face, and she's a brunette. So, I meant from the genre, you know, for the Giallo type, spacey woman. Yeah, okay. Yeah. And she says, this is
spacey city woman.
This is where my sister lived until she was murdered. So that came out of nowhere. I thought, whoa, holy exposition, Batman. So her sister was murdered, and we find out later who was responsible for that. So very, very funny, and consistently referring to jocks as jock straps, which is funny because, like, I don't know, John Saxon is not an intimidating figure, like, all 5'8" of his, like, you know, toupee dome and everything, and just his glowering doesn't cut that much of an impact when you compare it to, let's say, his role in Nightmare on Elm Street again, where there's kids involved and he comes in as an older authority figure that really carries some weight. Here he's just so ridiculous, getting in the face of what actually look like pretty badass, tough guy looking bikers. I mean, this is an 80s movie, but these guys are not to be trifled with. They got chains.
It's funny too, because it's like, it's in a city, in a town where, you know, it's notorious for being besieged by spring breakers, and spring breakers, you know, they do things that are sort of skirting the law.
Yep.
And also a town is besieged by a biker gang, the Demons. It seems like the police force is a one-man police force, and that's John Saxon only. There's also, of course, the aforementioned medical examiner who works closely with the police, and there's a priest as well.
Yeah. Well, the medical examiner was fantastic, because I don't know, I didn't fact-check this, but it's possible for any town whose ranks explode during particular times of the year that maybe their services would be overrun by these thousands of multitudes descending on it. So what they actually set up, and again, I don't know if they actually do this, but there's almost a MASH unit set up. And I don't know whether that was by design, by the producers who lacked the budget to film the interior of a hospital, but this looks like some sort of warehouse.
Yeah.
So, but you never know. Well, if the town is maybe 10,000, and then for 2 weeks of the year it becomes 60,000, like, these people have to go somewhere, and the hospital can't accommodate it, and it's not worth building one just for a bunch of people who need their stomach pumped or what and other things. So, I don't know. That was pretty funny. Cliches abound in this. The wonderful, the time-honored, this is par for the course in so many horrors, where I'm going to go investigate, and then the interlocutor says, but you can't go alone, it's too dangerous, and, you know, which is just a classic, like, I'm going to go investigate, you can't do that, I'm coming with you. Of course, you're coming with you at your own peril. And then the other one, whereas the victim walks backward, away from the noise, backward, and into the arms of the killer, which is fantastic. So really, this is a procedural for half of it, mm-hmm. amidst these pretty glorious kills.
Yeah, I mean, they're not gory per se, but they, because the elocute, I can't even say it.
You can't even elocute. Elocution,
yeah. Elocution. Evolve, you get these wonderfully burned, charred corpses, which I really appreciated.
Now, there's a really dour horror involving an arsonist, and you're going to have to, I think it might be Bloody Wednesday, but correct me if I'm wrong.
I know.
There's a killer who's...
Is that the Thanksgiving one that you always talk about?
I think it might be. There's a killer who's flashes back to setting fires, and his MO is using a blowtorch and setting fires. So, but this killer also uses a boiler room and sets one of his victims on fire, so that deviates somewhat from his electrocution MO. So it's just kind of weird too, but a glorious like Fulci-esque face melt of the victim there. And... different great killings and, you know, kind of engaging, silly, sort of dimwit who threw, again, the five interceptions, who's at a loss trying to figure out what to do. And he, I think in a couple of occasions, he goes to the biker clubhouse and tries to, like, spy on them through the barbed wire, and he's like, hanging out in the bushes, and he's a one-man gang, too, which is pretty funny. Yeah. So between him and Stryker, like, there's no one dealing with... Like this gang.
That is all, yeah, exactly. And that is par for the course in Giallos, where the police are so ineffective that one of the either friends or relatives or spouses of one of the victims takes it upon themselves to sort of do their own investigation.
Yeah.
And we've seen that many, many times in Giallos. And I believe the name escapes me with the bridal house and everything. And
yes.
We podcast
with the fashion house. Oh, man, yeah. Was that even Seven Bloodstained Orchids?
That could have been.
It could have been. Oh my God! These jollies are all like, blending into one.
Mm. And so, yeah, and then they put on their own little dunderheaded investigation, which also kind of leads them into the path of the killer as well. So another cliche we could just throw in the pile on this one.
Yeah, and in terms of the movies that are this one is inspired by, there's the Jaws. Oh no. What is this going to do to our town's reputation as the bodies start to pile up? Which I never understood I could see that with a shark, maybe, but with this, wouldn't you want to put an end to the slasher's killings, or else it's surely going to cause bigger problems down the line? Two bodies.
They're covering it up right now during spring break, maybe to not alarm the spring breakers.
So then their
debauchery.
All right, no one reads newspapers anyway, so it's
course,
okay. A year later, it's another spring break, and the clock turns over,
By trying to. Put a band-aid on it in the short term, they're definitely making some, they're creating problems for them in the long term, for sure.
So. Now, oh my God, like the denizens of Nick's Bar, like these people are unbelievable. Like, hey baby, can I get your number right off the bat? Like a guy pounding on the top of the bar, demanding a beer, like just pounding his fist.
That's what you do. That's your home, our local saloon.
And so many people thrown out and just like the awful behavior. And speaking of awful, I got to say, I mean, the ear-piercing, terrible soundtrack of this. And I found out that it was who was responsible was one of a long-time Ted Nugent co-writer and collaborator responsible for this 80s screeching guitar. It reminded me a lot of Loverboy crossed with Wasp. So like a little bit of a harder edge and a little bit of Motley Crue thrown in. Yeah. And they wasted no opportunity to fill every empty second with this just noodling awful guitar, and oh my God. But weird, because the actual concert at Manatee Beach that all these throngs are so enamored by is more of a new wave band with a guy sporting a headband and like these lengthy saxophone solos and leotards and that. So that was like really cross purposes with the metal that everyone was jamming out to at Nick's Bar. So mm-hmm. it makes you wonder, like, this really straddles the new wave plus the metal era of that time. So this was what, 89 that this came into being? Like, oh my God.
Obviously filmed in 88 because somebody was wearing a shirt that said 88 on the back. It came out in 89.
And another movie that this one taps is Assault on Precinct 13, is out of the blue. I guess you figure because there's only one police officer in
of any import,
of any import laying down the law in Manatee Beach that the bikers actually rob.
Isn't the manatee your favorite animal? I believe you mentioned that.
No, but it's the first animal I remember from being a kid, as I was down in Florida and I saw this giant thing under the water and I thought it was a whale, and then later I found out, you know, it was the the sloth-like wonderful mammal, the manatee. And So they assault on Precinct 13. They storm the police station, and there's like one guy left to defend it who's not Stryker, John Saxon, and he's like grabbed around the neck, and they rob the station. And I was thinking, like, do you remember?
You don't remember that?
Because it was so brazen. Because what better thing to do when you're being investigated for a spate of murders than, you know, poke the bear of the local constabulary and just, you know, rob them? It's, I don't know. It's so bizarre. This thing was really, really wacky. And you alluded to the male nudity. There's several instances of guys like gyrating for this. So even though there's like bikini wet shirt t-shirt contests and all this, there's guys dropping their drawers and showing their cracks, and it was odd. And I'm not aware of any wet t-shirt contest in Florida or elsewhere that actually involves toplessness, because it's the whole point of the wet t-shirt is to wet it. And the girls here were just doffing everything.
I don't know if you recall, I mean, did you ever watch Ed the Sock?
Ed
the Sock. Ed the Sock was this local television personality, and he was what he was. He was a sock puppet.
Yeah.
And he was pretty...
It predated...
Triumph the Insult.
Comic Dog.
And he was pretty cantankerous, and he was pretty...
he had a cigar, so he had a vaudeville kind of
thing
going. Yeah.
And on his show, they would often show clips of Spring Break debauchery, and they would show wet t-shirt contests, and because the show was on our beloved City TV, which would... you know, basically show everything and anything at the late hour. Yeah, there was definitely toplessness and nudity.
I think more so in the, maybe in the Spanish Quarter, New Orleans style, where, yelling it out, show me your tits kind of thing. But in the context of the contest.
I believe it was in Daytona, Florida.
Wow. Like, we certainly missed out, didn't we? I mean, you know, we did our...
Did you ever go to Wasega Beach for
I have, but it was the extent of the carnage and the, you know, and the lustiness and all this stuff is not nowhere close to that
lasciviousness.
We spent our university years in Toronto, and we had nothing of any consequence to do here. There's nothing in spring break. Everyone here tends to go to Mexico, and then that kind of debauchery happens in Cancun and all that. So that's where spring breakers go here. If not, I don't think they partake
in... I was in Cancun for a bit of spring break.
What was that like?
It was pretty nuts. I mean, considering the fact I wanted a quiet vacation after about a year spent traveling the globe, and I...
And Cancun was your destination of
choice? Well, it was because we went with a mutual friend, and he convinced me to go to Cancun, and I had no clue that it was during American spring break. So,
Yeah, so that probably came with it, everyone wearing, either next to nothing or various university affiliations, with which I never understood. Like, when I was in New Orleans for New Year's, it's the same kind of thing. Bourbon Street, all these people wearing, like, fucking Arkansas State and University of Alabama and all this stuff. Like,
you got to represent, my friend.
Who gives a crap, though? You're in, like, I don't know. I don't get it, but... And I actually got out of Bourbon Street really quickly because there was vomit coming at me from all sides, and it was pretty gross. Like, there was people getting arrested everywhere.
Yeah.
So, I mean, its reputation precedes it, and like we bolted out of there and found some bar in a different part of town. But there was fights, there was this piss, there was fisticuffs everywhere. It was just like a complete shitstorm brouhaha, and I can imagine Daytona Beach being just like... I can't... It's gross. I mean, Wasega, I guess we get a taste of that. Mm. And
Wasega, for our listeners, obviously, they don't know, what is it? It's north of Toronto?
Yeah, beach town on one of our great lakes that everyone goes there and just gets shit-faced. And there's, for about 2 months of the year, it's just a rip-roaring beach town with these bars right by the waterfront. It's really exciting.
Every month of the year, but it's not rip-roaring.
Yeah, and that's bad, too. And people just get completely... shit-faced. Where are we now?
We are at the time in the podcast when we'll discuss what did we learn.
Oh, my God.
I will begin.
Okay.
So, this killer was pretty badass looking. He cut a really striking figure. I mean, he, like I said before, he was dressed head to toe in leather. He had the awesome black motorcycle helmet with the visor completely obscuring his face. And yet, when they reveal who the killer is without spoiling anything, it's so incongruous to the attire
of this
person that it just makes everything, it belies everything you've seen before.
It's true. It is a shock, but no pun intended, given his MO, but it's not a good kind of shock.
No, it's not. And it's sort of a very lazy MO too, to be honest with you. But, you know, I mean, this image of the killer is the poster of the movie, and it's fucking badass. I can just imagine, like, somebody actually buying the poster going, oh man, this is cool. You got this motorcycle helmeted killer, you got this backdrop of Spring Break, and then you watch the movie and you're like, that's who I have on my wall?
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Honestly,
like, the killer itself,
especially since he's brandishing this garrote, and it's like don't forget the cannolis in The Godfather. I mean, that's his MO for a lot of the killings, and which is, you know, when he's not electrocuting them, he's doing that. He's brandishing that, and you're thinking, oh, this is really sinister. I mean, there's a bunch of motorcycle-clad killers in the horror pantheon. I'm thinking, this is a liberal use of the word horror, but it's quite horrible. Rotor, of course, and then the other being the Boston Set University slasher Night School, which has another motorcycle killer, and then, of course, the numerous... giallos that would have that. I mean, if not a motorcycle glove, then, you know, that's that kind of mask. Yeah, then, what I a mean, poster.
You're sort of going away from horror, but there's Nightwires by George Romero and so on. And
they could have made a really interesting, let's say more interesting, developed character out of him. Like, he could have been lurking in the shadows, he could have run people off the road. They could have made more of his mien or his, like, his look of his MO, like, to do something a little with that. Like, he could have been called upon people for roadside assistance, he could have ran them off the road, he could have run over them with his bike. It's pretty funny that he would, like, take someone's hand and then touch it on this weird electrified trident. It made very little sense, but hey, what can you do? There's only so many ways you can really kill people, and I thought that was pretty unique. And the only reason it didn't make it into our book, Death by Umbrella, the 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons, is because killing someone with a motorbike is not exactly novel. This would have been the twist on it that would have made it novel, but still, yeah,
twist being that people had to actually touch a motorcycle.
Yeah, but then that's just sort of splitting hairs, and then really, given the other demises we had with, like, a electric guitar with a
homicycle. I mean, that was
homicycle. Oh, Brett Kelly's homicycle. I believe he used it might have been a toilet plunger in that movie.
Okay.
But that's another motorcycle. Yeah, and that was inspired by Rotor. So, good call. So that's four off the top of our head there. It's a weird genre. I don't even know if does it qualify as a subgenre, the motorcycle killer.
Yeah, I would say so.
Hmm. So how does this compare to other Umberto Lenzi efforts?
Apparently, I saw this on IMDb, and my memory's kind of failing me, but Umberto Lenzi pretty much took himself off the project. And because of the wackiness and because of the what he considered to be the unseemliness of it all, and even though he is listed as a director...
This is from the guy who did Eaten Alive, but that's okay.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. Where he threw a mongoose into a gaping maw of a snake, and then claimed that it was it just happened upon it. But
he was David Attenborough.
Yeah,
South American mongoose.
He took himself off and said that he was basically more or less just a technical advisor on the picture, and some other gentleman whose name does not come to mind at the moment was the director. I could look it up right now, but I'm just not going to. But when you say how is it compared to other Umberto Lenzi films, it's really not an Umberto Lenzi film because he, once again, although listed as the director, was not really the director.
Hmm. Oh, well, one thing I learned was just great, and this guy did get his comeuppance, but he was extremely irritating. It's par for the course, too, in slashers where you have this gag guy who has all these accoutrements.
Oh yeah.
And so, and when we first meet him, and he doesn't get even, he's not even bestowed with a name, but he's in a pool and he creates this scene where there's blood and people think he's injured himself and they dive in to help him. it's just a prosthetic. And then later in the bar, he sidles up to it and pulls out a knife and stabs his hand, scaring the bejesus out of the bartender.
Does he also feign a shark attack at one point?
Oh, yes. Yeah, he has one of those dorsal fin you know, things that he's swimming around with, and which was a hilarious scene. I'm going to add another thing to what I learned. If you see a shark, is pulling out your six shooter and like firing a couple rounds at it really going to be efficacious? The beaches scatter, and this guy says, whoa, it's only a joke. He gets his comeuppance.
Yeah, so this guy was sort of like Shelley in Friday the 13th Part 3, and they're always there, they're always annoying, and they always get their comeuppance. So.
They're just desserts. Oh, another thing I learned, there's this ridiculous subplot of this buxom blonde who is luring lecherous men into her hotel room under different auspices. In one case, it's to pay for med school, and another is to pay for law school, and these guys come out of the room as if she's a prostitute, and she's actually a masseuse, and it's totally irrelevant, and it's played for, I don't know what purpose that serves. She later becomes a victim, if I'm not mistaken, but you do find out, oh, she's a masseuse and not a whore. There's a guy who, again, for comic relief, a la Shelley, there's a guy who screams, "Gators! Gators!" as he's being arrested and at various party scenes, so they reprise that gag four times. And the Gators is the nickname of the university.
That was kind
of
funny.
It was. University of Florida football team, so there's some sort of reference to that. Yeah. Oh, another thing I've learned, and this will be the final thing, is the music here. Part of it was Claudio Simonetti, the goblin principal, best known for Contamination and a slew of other Fulci films and all that. So he can't be held responsible for the ear-shattering, awful noodling on the guitar, but the rest of it, it's on him. Probably not his finest hour here. Star rating.
Well, before that, I just want to reiterate how egregious it was. Like, you know, you're trying to...
Oh, demons as well, Claudio Simonetti.
You're trying to cover up these killings, and to take one of the victims and throw him in a fucking quarry and cover him up with limestone. I'm going to give him a proper burial, not alert his...
His next of kin. And also to use the shovel to bury him to wipe fingerprints of a guy you're trying to frame. I mean, that's dirty. Dirty. Yeah, police. Like, dirty. LAPD has got nothing on this guy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, damn striker you. star rank for me for this film is a solid 3 stars. It was a fun romp, and I really appreciated the look of the killer. I appreciated the MO of the killer. I appreciated the victims, the way they looked after they came in contact with the killer. I really liked the charred corpses. Bit different than your usual slasher film where you have your arterial sprays and what have you. So no, I had 3 stars for me, and it was a fun film. It wasn't a top shelf giallo like Seven Blessed Orchids. It wasn't anywhere near as fun as Nightmare City, that's for sure. And it definitely had nothing in common with any of Lindsay's cannibal films, but it was a fun movie. And whether or not Lindsay was the actual director of the film, as he claims he wasn't, I mean, but that could just be him in hindsight saying this film is kind of crap. I'm going to put the blame on somebody else. It doesn't matter. I'm giving it 3 stars. I liked it. Chris, what's your star rating?
Well, I watched it a couple times this week, and it doesn't reach the summit of hilarity of the likes of Nightmare Beach, which just...
Nightmare City.
Nightmare City. My bad. A.K.A. City of the Walking Dead.
Remember, they're not zombies.
They're not zombies. And the face melt here almost reminded me of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Like, it's that kind of, you know, the melt, and then you're left with these eyeballs. One of the gang members reminded me of one of the girls in The Warriors, who is sort of separated out from the gang, and she's tough, and she's wearing this pendant that belongs to one of the deceased, and she ties into all this. She is a link between Skip and the biker gang and the cops. That was really neat. I'm gonna push this close to 4 because this is a rip roaring. This is so dynamic. And again, these lines, it's like, eat your heart out, Dick Wolf. Like, this is where my sister lived before she was murdered. And this reveal that, oh, my friend was murdered. And the other friend says, oh my. If you told me one of our friends was murdered, oh my, would not be the first utterance, you know?
That would be, oh me, oh my.
Oh, yeah, exactly. I'm going to give this 3.75.
Wow, that's a lofty rating.
Oh my God. Like, and you can, I think it's pretty apparent in the finished product that Lindsay had distanced himself from it, because his other work shows a kind of visual sophistication that this one is really, frankly, lacking. But we're not going to, I mean, we can't take umbrage with the cinematography or anything. It's just sort of... Like, it just, it doesn't have his his stamp. And so I could see that he distanced himself from it. It doesn't have
And I think another reason you're giving it 3 3/4 is because of the boobs. You're a boob hunter. And,
boob hunter.
There's quite a bit of boobs in this one.
Chris Lombardo, : boob hunter. Yeah. Oh, God. Oh, yeah. There's lots to look at, but there really
Laura
wasn't...
Croft, Tomb Raider, Chris Lombardo, boob hunter.
But it didn't use that conceit for anything... Like, let's put it this way. We did not need... the beach, because for a movie called Nightmare Beach, there was no killings on the beach. True. So it's pretty weird. So Manatee Beach, really the killings were all in hotel rooms or on these deserted roads and beside like
the and byways and whatever,
the clubhouse and of the gang of the demons gang. And yeah, I don't know, just a little bit of, but this movie goes by another title that was also on Amazon Prime. I can't even remember the I guess in the broader sense, this beach was a nightmare if you're only peripherally associated with it. It became a much bigger nightmare, and they could have nipped it in the bud very early because, yeah, again, no investigation went into any of it. Because you could have, let's say, at the crime scene, spotted tire tracks of somebody speeding away. Like if you're on a motorbike, maybe there would have been something. If someone's electrocuted and burned on a site, I mean, they do acknowledge that the victims were burned, but there was no follow-up investigation with this. Who would be so inclined to do this? There's a reference to Diablo, and the coroner hilariously said there's been instances where people have been electrocuted and they've turned into zombies, and so they're trying to like call back to the
not
red
exactly
hair.
What he said. He
well,
said,
I'm paraphrasing, but they're trying to add a little bit of clout and weight to this stupid red herring conceit. It's total horseshit. Like they could have. I don't know what. Like they could have, if they really wanted to build this up, and here I am 30 years after the fact offering advice, but they could have had a failed electrocution, and then they could have had the killer incapacitated who maybe escapes or is on the run, and then someone, you know, they speculate that that would be the killer's MO. So that's a way to better establish the red herring, not this, because that's absurd. There's no way. Like, you pronounce the guy dead, he's in the morgue, he's done for. So the fact that he could have been a zombie and survived this, I don't know, that really bizarre and ridiculous. And but again, at least this, I forget the doctor's name, but yeah, you mentioned him earlier, the genre stalwart who's been in Tarantino films and a long history in the 70s.
Red State by Kevin Smith was actually good movie by Kevin Smith. I mean, he hasn't made many of those, but one and Red State being another.
Well, this was like very, very spirited effort, very lively. The quintessential Saturday afternoon, bad weather, good, bad movie. Just, yeah, again, 3 3/4 for me. They're just becoming such a Lenzi fanboy. I can't, like, I own a Nightmare City shirt. I'm just so thrilled with that movie beyond belief. Like, it's such a glorious piece of art. It's outsider art, and this is not as far outside, but, man, it's well worth your time, as I hope you think the Really Awful Movies podcast is. Every Friday, new episodes uploaded for your listening pleasure, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
Thank you.